From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, putting on the spin. When it comes to damage control, our guest Eric Desenhall is the go-to guy. He's co-founder and president of the Washington, D.C. crisis management firm Nichols Desenhall and a former member of Ronald Reagan's White House communications office. Also, taking a family on a trip all the way around the world, we meet writer Daniel Glick, who took his two kids to see endangered natural wonders in Australia and Asia following the end of his marriage and the death of his older brother. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new self-titled CD from singer-songwriter Liz Phair. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. If you're a celebrity or run a corporation, your Rolodex might well include the phone number of my guest, Eric Dezenhall. He's a specialist in crisis communications management, advising high-profile clients when they get sued, investigated, or embarrassed by public accusations and media scrutiny. Dezenhall won't reveal the names of his clients, but he is widely quoted on the art of damage control. He says there are times to keep quiet, times to apologize, and times to attack your accuser. In addition to his communications management work in Washington, Dezenhall writes novels about a communications management specialist from South Jersey. His latest is called Jackie Disaster, about a Martha Stewart-like character accused of peddling toxic products whose reputation is saved by the spin doctor. Dezenhall's earlier novel, Money Wanders, tells the story of a damage control specialist who cleans up the public image of a South Jersey mob leader applying for an Atlantic City casino license. I asked Dezenhall how close the spin doctors of his novels come to his real-life persona.
Well, I think that I made it more abrasive to make a fictional narrative more interesting. In my day job, in my real life, I'm constrained by the law, ethics, reputation, but as a fiction writer, I'm not constrained by anything. So I ratchet up the attitude a bit, and my alter ego, Jackie Disaster, does some absolutely vile, despicable, and thoroughly illegal things in order to vindicate his clients. That's what makes for a more interesting read. In my day job, I'm not allowed to do those things. Can't pistol whip anybody, unfortunately, sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, the people in your book make Nixon's plumbers look like Boy Scouts. Is that your fantasy? Is that what you kind of wish you could do sometimes?
Well, you know, it's hard to be involved with civilization. When you're civilized and somebody cuts you off in traffic, you are limited in your responses. The thing about a guy like Jackie Disaster is if you cut Eric here off in traffic, the worst thing that's going to happen is I'll yell. If you cut Jackie off in traffic, you're dead. And I think that I am amazed to see what people get away with in terms of their passion for smearing a public figure or a business. And there are times that my id runs wild, and I think of things that I'd like to do, but of course can't.
Your books are set in South Jersey, home of Atlantic City, the Philadelphia South Jersey mob. What do you think they add to the feeling, the atmospherics of the book?
Well, South Jersey is, in effect, a character in my novels. I grew up there. I grew up around racketeers. I had some colorful people in my background, the kind of people who one time when I was a little kid, I asked my dad, I said, what does Uncle So-and-so do for a living? And my dad said, what kind of stupid question is that? I mean, I thought it was a perfectly innocent question. But what's interesting about it is...
Well, did Uncle So-and-so end up in some trouble?
Uncle So-and-so did end up with wearing an ankle collar for home detention. And I remember very vividly as a kid, I was around the time The Godfather came out. This is 1972. I was about 10 years old, and I went to see the movie. I snuck in because I heard that one of my neighbors was in the movie. And lo and behold, one of my neighbors was in the movie, Al Martino, who played Johnny Fontaine, the singer. And I totally bought into the whole Godfather ethic. And around that time, I was beaten up at school. And I came home and talked to my grandfathers, my uncles, and I wanted, just like in the movie, justice to be done for me. And they didn't have the remotest interest in justice. And finally, it was either my grandfather or my uncle said, look, you went on to an area of the playground where there were boys who were bigger. That means you're stupid. And you got beaten up. That means you're weak. What could we possibly do for somebody like you? And the great lesson to me is you believe the fantasies about this elite, secretive structure that protects its own. You believe this nonsense at your peril. What the rackets are and always were was a loose affiliation of crooks. That's all it is. It's about money. It's not about a noble lifestyle in any way, shape, or form. And I've had a lot of fun with the concept of how the public, the mafia, has been spun by Hollywood as an elegant organization, and it's just not something I believe. At the root of these things is something very banal, and the backdrop of organized crime and what they are versus what the culture wants to believe they are is a nice metaphor for spin control.
My guest is crisis communications management consultant Eric Dezenhall. His new book is Jackie Disaster. What are the principles of damage control? that you've written about is that when a high-profile target, one of your clients, is attacked, the attacks will stop only when the attacker himself is put at risk. Is that how this works? I mean, you've got to defend your client by attacking his critic?
That's often the case. As a general rule of thumb, if you're guilty, repent. If you're innocent, attack. But what has happened more and more is the whole damage control business has risen out of legitimate concerns. I mean, in the 1960s and 70s, you had Watergate, you had Vietnam, you had automobile companies sending private investigators to investigate Ralph Nader's sex life. You had legitimate bad things that happened. The problem is this has led to the rise of a culture of the watchdog, where the watchdogs themselves now need watching. And for many years, because America is an activist nation, we don't like the notion that anybody with an activist complaint should be asked a hard question. What I find, though, is in the 16 years I've had my own business, there is the tendency to view any attack on a public figure or a business interest as noble and any defense as somehow corrupt. And I'm absolutely unrepentant about defending somebody who I believe is wrongly attacked. I think the best case example that's in the public domain is years ago when Cardinal Joseph Bernardin was accused of molesting an altar boy. He was forced to actually fight an altar boy who it turned out was lying. And the way I like to describe my business, even though I had nothing to do with the Cardinal's case, is sometimes you have to fight the altar boy. And that's a lot of what Jackie Disaster does, and that's a lot of what I do.
Now, I've been a beat reporter for a lot of years, and I get tips all the time from people who want me to do a negative story about somebody. And most of them I don't do because the allegation is exaggerated, because it doesn't quite rise to the level of news, or quite often because the story just doesn't check out. Do you find reporters are different? Are they willing to just compromise their ethics and publicize somebody's attack even when it has no merit?
I think that a vast majority of reporters do not want to traffic in disinformation. But what I have found is a lot of reporters in the tabloid era enjoy validating an existing prejudice rather than diffusing it or disabusing people of it. And a lot of times what I have to do, and you'll see this come up in Jackie Disaster, is in a witch hunt, sometimes the only strategy is to switch the witch. And I think that the media have become very vulnerable to anybody with an allegation. Anybody with a modem is considered an expert. Anybody with a grievance is considered a reporter. And I think that recently reporters have caught on to the fact that they are being had by special interests of some kind and are more aggressive about it. But that being said, the rise of my business and the rise of my own writing is a direct can be directly correlated with the interest in negative information about businesses and public figures. Americans have a long history of a passion for witch hunts. And the reason why we like them is it's our notion of democracy. If you make it in America, it's only a matter of time before we want to stone you in the town square, and we validate our notion of democracy and equality by cutting somebody down who gets too far ahead of us.
Now, in both of your books, Jackie Disaster and Money Wanders, one of the techniques that the spin control artist does is to get on internet chat rooms and generate buzz, often with stuff, again, that's just inaccurate information, but would be helpful to the client. Is that something you do?
Well, we certainly can get involved with coalition building type efforts where you find people who are sympathetic to your client and you mobilize them. A lot of the internet chat room stuff, the mischief that you see in Jackie Disaster and Money Wanders, is culled directly from techniques that have been used to attack my clients over the years. The internet gives an illusion of grassroots. So a lot of times, for example, several years ago, there were rumors all over the internet that women's feminine care products contained asbestos and dioxin. And we found that these were information that was trafficked in chat rooms by a competitive interest. But the internet there's something about seeing something in print that gives it the proxy for authority. When you see it in writing, even if it's just on the internet, it looks as if it's been checked out. And a lot of times what we have to do is diffuse those tactics by getting onto chat rooms and seeing who exactly these people are.
Well, in that case, I assume it was your client whose products were being undermined with these false rumors. What did you do about it?
In that particular case, we were able to determine through a forensic investigation on the internet that the person, that the thousands of emails that were going into newsrooms across the country alleging that consumers were being injured were in fact sent by one person thousands of times. But the news media, having seen all of these emails, they began to think there was a legitimate grassroots of injured people. And what we did is we went to the news media. I mean, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And one of the things, as much as I'm willing to criticize the news media, when they get hold of a scam, especially an internet, a technology-driven scam, the news media have been very ethical about coming out and exposing it.
It's interesting that what you're describing are occasions in which critics of your corporate or celebrity clients use these unethical tactics, the internet, bogus stories, and you're in the position now of having to play by the rules and ferret those out and diffuse them. In your books, you want to be like them. You want to use those tricks to get the opponents.
Well, your point is very accurate. I mean, what my clients come up against is really guerrilla warfare. They are up against smaller entities, trial lawyers, activist groups, individuals with allegations, and they can't really fight them back because it looks like when the big celebrity fights back against a little person with an allegation or a corporation does something like that, it looks unfair. And one of my id fantasies is to be able to use the tactics that are used against my clients. I got to tell you, regardless of what you think about corporations, if you think for a minute that a large blue chip corporation would sign off on the kind of tactics that I use and my character uses in Jackie Disaster, you have another thing coming. I mean, these type of vicious tactics are more effectively used by guerrilla forces than by large entities.
My guest is crisis communications consultant Eric Desenhall. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Eric Desenhall. He's a crisis communications consultant in Washington, and he's also written a new novel, Jackie Disaster. When do you advise your clients to apologize?
I think that if a client has a pattern of having done something wrong and their attacker has them dead to rights, it pays to embark on a program of repentance. One of the things you'll see in Jackie Disaster is what Jackie determines about his client is that even though she did some things wrong, the thing people really hate about her is that they lost control of her. Everybody liked this domestic diva when she was small time and when they had a role in building her. When they hated her was when she got above them. And there is a scene toward the end of the book where she engages in what is an act of penitence of sorts. I mean, the great myth of damage control is the myth of the unblemished escape, the whole idea that you can pull a cute trick and get out of it. But there has to be a reckoning. There has to be a price if you really did it. And a lot of what we have done for a living is help walk a client through that kind of repentance and forgiveness. That being said, there is a great myth that apologies are the best damage control strategy. I haven't found this to be the case. I mean, you have House Speaker Livingston apologize, lost his job. You have Jimmy Swaggart and the Reverend Jim Baker apologize, they lost their pulpits. Bill Clinton lied and left office with the highest approval ratings you can imagine. So the whole idea that there's a correlation between repentance and forgiveness is not always the case.
You mentioned that Bob Livingston, and the House Speaker, and the Reverend Jimmy Swaggart did not get away with apologies for their transgressions. Was that because they weren't simply sinners but preachers? I mean, was there a self-righteousness that angered people?
You know, a lot of my Republican friends have said to me during the Clinton-Lewinsky affair, you know, the media would never let Republicans get away with this. And I said, that's right. That's because one of the problems or the challenges Republicans have is when you preach morality, you can't have an affair. And so a lot of it comes down to hypocrisy versus truth or not truth. And one of the problems that Congressman Livingston ran into was that he was up against people who are hammering the issue of hypocrisy versus whether or not Clinton told the truth or didn't tell the truth. And one of the things that you have to keep in mind in a damage control situation is we evaluate not just what you say, but who you have said you are and who somebody could make you out to be. And when Bill Clinton defended himself against having an affair, we all kind of knew what we bought when we got into it. And when Ronald Reagan said dumb things or George Bush's W. Bush mispronounces stuff, we knew what they were to begin with. So we don't have that shock to the system that you have when somebody preaches and then turns around and is alleged to have done something that is quite the opposite of what they preached.
You've written that there are different kinds of PR challenges. There are nuisances, there are problems, and there are crises, and that sometimes clients will mistake one for the other. Do you ever find a client who's been attacked and wants to give a full-bore outraged response when the smartest thing to do is just keep their mouth shut?
This happens all the time. You know, somebody asked me, a reporter asked me a few weeks ago, you know, what is it about these corporate and celebrity clients that they just don't apologize? And I said, you know, in 20 years of doing this, I have not once, ever, had a client look at me and say, you know what, I did dump the acid in the river, and let me tell you why I did. I thought it would be cheaper to dispose of that way, and, you know, frankly, I didn't think anybody would catch me. The fact is the first thing that happens in a crisis is the first thing that happened in the Bible when Adam and Eve were embarrassed. They covered up. The cover-up is a visceral reaction, and I have yet to find somebody who, at least in the short term, who will look at their behavior and said, you know, I did something wrong. They tend to want to strike back when, in fact, they don't always realize they have little moral equity. Celebrities, by the way, are the worst because they are surrounded by sycophants who basically tell them that any form of outrageous behavior is absolutely acceptable, and anybody who would seek to deprive you of behaving that way is just jealous. So I often have to refuse to work with a celebrity client because you just can't get through to them. Often the best thing for them to do is to disappear, but you can't get a celebrity to dig a hole. They think the answer to everything is yet another People magazine cover shot.
You worked in the Reagan White House. I'm curious about how you would handle George Bush as a president, somebody who misspeaks at times, but also seems to have a gift for imagery. I mean, he did very well with landing on the deck of that aircraft carrier in a flight suit. How would you handle George Bush?
I believe that George W. Bush, his vulnerability, his malapropisms are an asset, not a liability. You know, he could very well have suffered the fate of somebody like Ted Kennedy, which is the prodigal son, the rich man who thinks he's better than anybody and who can get away with stuff. What I think about Bush is when he pronounces something wrong, while people on the Upper West Side of New York and Malibu might laugh down their noses, there's a whole heartland out there that mispronounces things too. And we find that to be endearing. And while those who are inclined to hate George Bush find his mispronunciations evidence of his stupidity, people in the heartland find it evidence that he is not, in fact, a superior rich kid, that he's no better than any one of us. And one of the most brilliant things Bush did is during his first campaign when he was asked, you know, is it true that you only got where you did because of your family? Rather than saying no, he said, yeah, you know, that's basically true. And man, am I lucky. And I think that his anchor in knowing who he is and knowing what his vulnerabilities are an asset. I mean, it's sort of like friends used to ask me, boy, what did you Reagan White House staffers used to say when Reagan would make a stupid comment like, 98% of pollution is caused by trees. And everybody thought that there was this gigantic spin machine. And what I said to one friend of mine who hated Reagan is, do you want to know what we really said to the press? And they said, yeah. And I said, we said to the press, he says stuff like that. I mean, that was your brilliant spin. But he said it, and he says stuff like that. And so there's really nowhere to go with it because people basically knew who it was they were voting for.
Eric Dezenhall, he's a crisis communications consultant, and his new novel is called Jackie Disaster. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by IFC, presenting A Decade Under the Influence, 70s films that changed everything. Directed by Richard LeGrevenace and Ted Demme, premiering August 20th at 8 p.m. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with damage control expert Eric Dezenhall. Also, writer Daniel Glick tells us about taking his two kids on an adventure around the world. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new self-titled album from Liz Phair. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with damage control expert Eric Dezenhall. He's co-founder of Nichols Dezenhall Communications Management Group. You've said, Eric, that some of your clients are guilty. Are there times you have pangs of conscience that wonder, my God, how did I get into this? How can I defend these people?
Yeah, I think that, public relations is about telling pretty lies. Damage control is about telling ugly truths. And there have been times, and this is one of the reasons why I write, that I do wrestle with the morality of the situation. I mean, what happens when you get a client that really doesn't have the remotest interest in repenting? And yes, there are moral issues, but there's also, I think, other things that are frustrating. I think that the public often believes in what I like to call the fallacy of evil men, the notion that anybody who does something, is accused of doing something wrong, you know, did so in a plotting way. I think what's more frustrating to me is that I don't really find a lot of evil, but what I do find is a lot of carelessness, stupidity, bad things that happen basically because the entity wanted to cover their rear ends rather than solve the problem. And it's these type of workaday frustrations that I find very, very difficult, not this grand notion of evil. It's that the very same people who think that corporations do naughty things to get away with something, what often is the case is you have a corporation that is inactive, can't do anything, basically because everybody is so terrified of going into the CEO and telling him they have a problem that you can't even do anything for them, that you have an inoperable case.
Are there certain clients you simply won't take?
Yes. I have refused certain criminal defendants. I've done some plenty of legal work, but I don't really want to represent murderers, especially somebody I think did it. I don't do tobacco work. My mother died young of cancer. I do pro bono work on cancer issues, and it's very difficult to look somebody like you in the eye and say, why are you saying that tobacco causes cancer? There's no evidence of that. I mean, I can't do that. I would much rather do my righteous indignation routine. I mean, Jackie Disaster tells his priest that he spends his career in search of a lower truth, that he spends his career searching out ugly truths. I have no problem using hardball tactics to vindicate someone who I think is wrongly accused, but I don't really want to be running across the countryside telling people that tobacco does not cause cancer.
There are certainly other companies that do things that are believed to contribute to cancer or cause cancer. I mean, do you draw the line simply at tobacco, or do you ever find yourself dealing with somebody who's suspected of spreading a carcinogen?
We confront things like that all the time, but I think that there is a very big difference between scientific evidence proving that something is a carcinogen and cultural speculation that something is. I mean, I've done a lot of petrochemical work, and you know, we've conducted opinion research that shows that if you completely make up the name of a chemical, 70% of the public will identify it as a proven carcinogen, basically because we have very much have drawn an association between petrochemicals and cancer, where I am not convinced that there's a scientific link the way I am convinced that there is one with tobacco. I mean, just because something may feel kind of like a carcinogen doesn't mean it is. And one of the things that distresses me is how easy it is just to float the allegation and watch the culture and the news media pick up on it. So I am unapologetic about working with companies where there is an allegation that is unsubstantiated and largely probably untrue.
You came into possession of the famous gangster Meyer Lansky's diaries. How did that happen?
His granddaughter, Cynthia Duncan, and I became friends. And, you know, those of us who grew up around interesting elders, there is a certain bond. There is either a desire to justify what they did. There is a desire to set the truth out. There is a desire to correct the record. And we sort of bonded over this. And when Meyer's widow died, his granddaughter shortly after mentioned that he had taken notes. And I flew down and spent some time with him. And what was interesting about Meyer was very much cut from the same cloth as a lot of the old timers that I grew up around in Philly and South Jersey. And what's interesting is whereas the culture ascribes to these guys vast, vast powers. I mean, Meyer was called the chairman of the board of organized crime. The reality of them is their rhetoric was very much, Meyer's rhetoric was that of a tiny immigrant who was very bitter and who was chased out of business by the corporations. And that very much paralleled some of the things that I heard from the old timers around me. I mean, I remember when I got into an Ivy League college when I was 18, one of my uncles said, "Hey, big shot, Mr. Ivory League." And I said, "No, you mean Ivy League." And the fact that he couldn't speak correctly, I mean, this was not the rhetoric of a man, whether it was my old uncle or Meyer Lansky, of a guy with great power. It was the rhetoric of somebody who had very low self-esteem, who recognized their powerlessness, who recognized that in a fight between an old racketeer and a large corporation with the capacity to launch an initial public offering, the corporations are going to beat him every time.
Do you love to go back to South Jersey, hear the accents, and listen to these characters sit on the boardwalk?
You know, I do. And a lot of it is, you know, people always ask me the things I write about, whether it's in Money Wanders, where my alter ego is a Washington-based pollster and the grandson of an old Jewish crime boss. I mean, people ask me, do I know a lot of these things to be true? And I fully admit that what I don't know that I make up. But what's fun is to go back and hear the accents, hear the references to the way things used to be, even if the way things used to be weren't so much better. And, you know, there are just not a lot of books set in South Jersey, and both of mine are. And what's interesting about South Jersey is there is a certain chip on our shoulders for those of us who grew up there. North Jersey, you can always say you're a New Yorker. But South Jersey is neither New York nor is it Philly. So there is this certain, what are you looking at, ethic there that is fun to tap into. But I do like going back there, especially as a published writer who can have fun with the locality. I mean, people back there like the story of how I got a literary agent. I had so much rejection that I figured that, you know, given that my books deal with tough guys, why not start writing death threats? So I sent my pitch letter to literary agents, opened up by saying, "It's a nice literary agency you got there. I wouldn't want to see nothing happen to it." And people back there love that story. They love the notion that you can succeed by, rather than denying what you came from, sort of wrapping yourself up in it and exaggerating a little and throwing it in somebody's face.
Did that work?
Yeah, it did work. I mean, a literary agent took me on rather quickly and said, "Look, you know, Eric, I've had all kinds of clever pitch letters, but I've never had such a well-worded, open death threat sent to me." And she took me on and we got published. I had so much rejection for my nonfiction book that I figured I would risk making enemies in order to get my novels published. And the death threats worked.
Did she kind of believe it?
Well, you know, it's funny when you write about the rackets and when you acknowledge having had some colorful characters in your background, there's people who they really kind of want to believe it. But no, I don't think that anybody who knows me or who knows my background could possibly think that I would exercise some sort of, violent option. It's just something I have fun with. But I think people just get a whole kick out of the fantasy that, well, somebody can pick up the phone, call somebody and have somebody killed. I quite frankly don't think that that's possible or that big an achievement if it is.
Is it true you collect campaign songs from the presidential campaign against Martin Van Buren in 1836?
I collect old-time political campaign buttons and campaign songs. And one of the reasons why is it gets back to spin control. We love to think that viciousness is something in our modern age. But the fact is if you look at old campaign materials, I mean, people were saying Abraham Lincoln was an illiterate baboon. One of the campaign songs against Martin Van Buren, I recall the lyrics, "Who never did a noble deed, who deserves the lowest place in hell, Van Buren." We were vicious way back then, too. What makes our times different is we like to think that we're classier, but America has always been has always rejoiced in beating up on the other guy because it's one step short of violence, which would, of course, make it a dictatorship of some kind. So it's fun to look back and see that our founding fathers with their powdered wigs were actually really rough customers.
I know you're a good mimic. Can you sing us your favorite campaign song?
You know, I'm not. I don't think that I could sing one because I don't think that I know all the tunes, but I remember the Van Buren one was basically filled with rhetoric that compared him to a baboon and justified why he was going to hell. And what's so funny is when you hear people talk about how George W. Bush is stupid, if you look at what was said about Abraham Lincoln, Democrats have always attacked Republicans by saying they're idiots, and Republicans have always attacked Democrats by saying they're moral lepers. This goes back hundreds of years. So even some of the things that we think are new are really not. And a lot of the damage control strategies that you see that even I thought were original years ago go way back. I mean, damage control goes back to the Bible. The first damage control guy was Moses' brother Aaron. It was Aaron's job to basically tell these people wandering across the desert, hey, look, this is going to be great. We're going to have oceanfront views. We're going to have milk and honey, promised land. This is going to be terrific. And ultimately, it came to Moses when he had to deal with people protesting in the desert to send in special forces and beat up people who didn't go along. So you had this damage control strategy of both Aaron, the spin doctor, saying this Holy Land is going to be great, to Moses, who occasionally had to hire a guy like Jackie Disaster to go in and pistol whip people to getting in line. So spin control has always been about both the muscle and the rhetoric.
So maybe you really are in the oldest profession.
You know, I think it's possible.
Eric Dezenhall, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Damage control expert Eric Dezenthal. He's a Washington, D.C.-based communications consultant. His new novel is called Jackie Disaster. Years ago, environmental writer Daniel Glick was enjoying professional success but struggling with calamities in his personal life. His wife had left their 15-year marriage for a lesbian relationship, making Glick a single father of two children, age 9 and 13. A year after that, Glick's older brother died of male breast cancer. Glick, who had long found personal renewal in travel, decided to take his children on a 5-month around-the-world tour, focusing on endangered species and disappearing natural wonders. The journey is recorded in Glick's new book, Monkey Dancing, A Father, Two Kids, and a Journey to the Ends of the Earth. Daniel Glick worked for Newsweek for 12 years and has written for a variety of publications, including Rolling Stone and the New York Times Magazine. Let's start with a reading from Monkey Dancing.
In the middle of the night, after my daughter Zoe woke me for the third time because she was afraid of the snakes, I wondered, not for the first time, whether this trip had really been such an inspired idea. Earlier, Zoe had been complaining about leeches, and before that, mosquitoes, and it dawned on me that unless you were raised in the rainforest, accustomed to strangler figs and spiders the size of gerbils, Borneo was a pretty forbidding environment. For a 9-year-old girl reared in suburban Colorado, this place looked downright menacing. My 13-year-old son Kolya, also awakened by his sister, didn't help things when he authoritatively informed Zoe that, since she was the smallest mammal among us, any predator would obviously eat her first.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Glick, you're an environmental writer, and you organized a lot of this trip around a focus on several endangered species, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, orangutans in Borneo, rhinos in Vietnam, tigers in Asia. And you use your journalistic contacts to get some pretty sophisticated looks behind the scenes of conservation efforts. And I'm wondering, were any of these stories particularly compelling to the kids? Did they catch on? Did they appreciate what they were getting?
Well, something happened fortuitously early in the trip that really set the tone. We were in Queensland in Australia, which is where the rainforest meets the reef, the Great Barrier Reef, and the Daintree rainforest. And I had been telling the kids about this particular animal called a cassowary, which is cousin to the emu and ostrich, the world's, second largest bird, flightless and endangered because of land clearing, because of all kinds of human activity that's constricting its habitat. And I was giving the kids one of my little eco lectures when they were rolling their eyes and saying, oh, Dad, come on, please, we don't need all this. And all of a sudden, we saw a cassowary by the side of the road we were driving on. And we got out of the car and we watched it disappear into the forest. From there, we went to an ice cream parlor where they had served all these macadamia nut and papaya and coconut and these wonderful exotic fruit ice creams. And the woman who had been serving us, we had gone back there 3 or 4 days in a row, said that we were very, very lucky to see a cassowary because even the locals didn't get to see them very often. And that the cassowary had some interesting habits given our circumstances, that the females lay the eggs and then they split. And it's the male cassowaries who hatch the eggs and who take the chicks and live with them for a year and teach them everything they need to know. And even the kids understood that this was almost a magical metaphor for what had happened to us. And at one point, Kolya said to me, Pop, that's what you meant. You wanted to take us to see some of these things before they're gone, didn't you? And I said, you got it. That's what we're out to do here. I thought of this as a before they're gone tour. One of the before they're gones was to take the kids to see these places of great ecological wonder before they disappeared. The second was to spend some time with my kids and really get to know them and have them get to know me before they were gone, before they fledged my single father's nest. And the third before they're gone was the big one, mortality. My brother died at 48. He was one of the healthiest human beings I knew. He was an athlete. He was a doctor. He took really very, very good care of himself. And he died so early and so young that I figured what we all know is that we can't guarantee how long we're going to be around. And I wanted to really live life on my own terms before it was gone, my own life was gone.
You say late in the book, in the epilogue, that grief and loss, you've come to believe, provide the glue that binds humanity together. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. That thought occurred to me after I had had a conversation with a Nepali man who ran a shop where I was, and he had told me that he had gotten divorced, which was unusual, not only because divorce is relatively rare in Nepal, but also because sharing that information with a stranger was fairly uncharacteristic. And he went on to tell me that his father had passed away from cancer the year before. And as I write in the book, fearful of matching him tragic revelation for tragic revelation, I shared with him my story. And we sat there together, and there was something that bound us together. And subsequent to writing the book, the letters I've gotten from people who can share one element or another or several of the losses that I've gone through, the death of a loved one to a disease or an accident or anything, or a divorce that shatters a family. It is grief and loss that is the most universal truth that we have as a species.
Were you together 24 hours a day? Did you and the kids have any time apart?
Very little. Occasionally we did. We met up with some friends along the way a couple times. Like I said, I had some friends in Phnom Penh. But for the most part, as the kids put it, we were together 24/7.
And how did you handle that? I mean, weren't there times that you wanted to just go away and be with adults?
There were. There was one place we were in Australia where, although we had rented a camper van, at one point I checked us into a kind of a traveler's haunt, and I got them into a little cabana, and I said, I'm going to the bar. And they said, we want to come. And I said, no, I'm going alone. And after a little tug of war, I just left them in this room and went and had a couple beers and came back, and they were snoring.
And as I recall, you discovered that sort of the local young adults kind of weren't that interested in a guy like you traveling with kids by himself.
Well, it's funny. I joked that, you know, being a single dad hardly makes you a babe magnet. And I was traveling with these two kids, and I was a single man. And I had asked a friend of mine who was divorced, what was the youngest woman he had gone out with? And he said he had some fail-safe theorem that you could have your age and then add 7. And I realized that by that theorem, I could go out with a 29-year-old woman, and there wasn't anybody even that old in the place. And so this was not a dating scene on this trip, and I quickly abandoned it. But that didn't allow me to completely abandon my fantasy life.
Well, Daniel Glick, thanks so much for talking with us.
And my great pleasure. Thank you.
Writer Daniel Glick. His book about the journey he took with his children is called Monkey Dancing. Coming up, Liz Phair returns to the music scene. This is Fresh Air. This summer, Liz Phair returned to record-making after taking a hiatus that included some time spent raising her first child alone. She came back to music to find the pop landscape had filled up with young female singers. Phair's response to was to turn to the group of pop songwriter-producers who called themselves The Matrix. The move proved to be controversial among Phair's fans and the rock press. Rock critic Ken Tucker offers this post-mortem on the summer's sellout scandal surrounding the album entitled Liz Phair.
So here I was, happily spinning pop rock records for you for a month or so, helping to turn you on to the High Strung as well as Fountains of Wayne. And all the while, the rock press was full of snarky profiles and nasty reviews of Liz Phair and her first album in 5 years, called Liz Phair. Liz, who wants you to know that she's a 30-something hot mom, also knows that she has to get her brand name out there through sheer repetition in this cluttered pop marketplace. She started off the album with the sort of self-affirmation we used to call empowering, a song about how extraordinary Liz Phair is, called Extraordinary. The thing is, it's not written by Liz Phair, but by the Hydra-headed team called The Matrix, producer-songwriters Lauren Christie, Scott Spock, and Graham Edwards. And the song itself, as you heard, isn't all that extraordinary. So why'd Liz do it? Lack of confidence in her own hook-bending abilities? Maybe. But a new song she did write, called It's Sweet, sure sounds good to me. Down on the Lower East Side, in the dirtiest apartment you could find, you took me up to your place, but the elevator threw me into space, and I really didn't. Personally, as a big fan of Phair's albums Exile in Guyville and the underrated White Chocolate Space Egg, I had no trouble hearing which songs were The Matrix and which songs were Liz. Any tune that was too on the nose, like one called Rock Me, were Matrix. Anything that evinced ambiguity, ambivalence, or amazing self-exposure was Liz. Like this song, in which Phair imagines what her little son thinks about seeing mom with a boyfriend.
Dig, little digger, don't be shy. You saw your mother with another guy. You think you'll tell her that she's one of a kind. You say, my. So he can get a better look at them. You say, this one's my favorite one. This one you can't have. I got it from my dad. You say,
the worst thing about Liz Phair's desire to craft a hit record by collaborating with The Matrix is that this became the story, pushing aside some extraordinary songs. Well, that and the kind of sad little spectacles I happened to stumble upon, like seeing Phair, every inch the empowered hottie with big guitar and spike heels, performing on Regis and Kelly at 9 a.m. in the morning. Our Liz deserves better.
I was a mess in my open eyed youth. I grew up thinking, what's good for one oppresses the other. It's my turn, my life, my way, my me. It made me crazy. I couldn't fight it. I couldn't wait to get away. It's a war with the whole wide world. It's a war with the boys and girls. It's a war, and nothing's gonna change. And nothing's gonna change.
When Phair sings on that song, it's sister and brother, mother and daughter, father, son, husband, wife thing. It's drugs, it's hunger, it's race, sex, and government. Well, when that's sung with her conversational urgency, I don't see how you can resist. But you did. The album never topped number 27 on the Billboard chart and is plummeting below 100 now. But this working mom is out on tour. The album is the kind of sellout we'd expect from her, an honest, ferocious, forthright one. And she deserves our support and, yes, our respect, especially when she's behaving most disrespectfully.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Place of Hiding, a novel of mystery set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George, author of the Inspector Linley Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Planet of the Umps, we meet baseball umpire Ken Kaiser. His new book is an inside look at fights on the field and tricks of the umpiring trade from his 23 years in Major League Baseball. Join us for the next Fresh Air.